as to the tobacco companies is using the strategy of doubt, either with public health information related to the tobacco industry or climate change, environmental or scientific findings in relation to this project.
Correct. Yeah, this has been, I call it in the article, the tobacco playbook, and that's exactly as you described, which is to make a two-sided debate out of something that's fairly one-sided. There may be some variations of the actual science, but there's sort of a legitimate scientific consensus right now. At least the book talks about climate change, and although climate change is a concern on the Keystone XL, there's also just a lot of other ecological issues in terms of water contamination, ruining farmland, ruining forest land, things that happen during actual tar sands extraction. That all these things are pretty much, you know, when you look at them as a whole, there's a scientific consensus around this issue. What this report does is make it a debate, and you know, sadly, this is an actual government document now. So it has the stamp of approval of both industry, which it contracted the study out to, but also now the State Department. And a lot of the mainstream media has been reporting this as, okay, well, they said that it's environmentally sound, not questioning who ERM Group is at all, and actually often not even mentioning that the State Department contracted this out to begin with, and that it wasn't even the State Department that did it, but it was TransCanada, the corporation that is actually going to be building this pipeline if it gets approval.
So a government document, but prepared by these outside companies. Another firm involved is ICF International. It has ties to a New York advisory panel on hydraulic fracturing. And then a third company is Ensis Energy. Now, what are its ties to the oil and gas industry?
Sure. So three of Ensis Energy's clients include ExxonMobil, BP, and Koch Industries. And the former two, ExxonMobil and BP, both have huge stakes in tar sands extraction itself. They own a lot of property in which they're extracting the tar sands, after which it gets moved by a company like TransCanada to the next company, which is Koch Industries. Koch Industries owns refineries, particularly in the Midwest. In the state of Minnesota, they own the Pine Bend refinery. In the state of Wisconsin, where I live, they own four refineries. The oil, or the tar sands, is refined there into something that's more easily transportable, and then it will go down to Port Arthur to be exported. So Ensis Energy, one of the groups that did the environmental impact statement on behalf of the State Department, has clients that are going to make potentially billions of dollars off of the tar sands itself. It's a huge conflict of interest, and it should be questioned heavily whether or not basically we can do this with any legitimacy.
Journalist Steve Horn with Counterpunch and DeSmog Blog joined us to break down the companies behind the State Department's environmental impact statement on the Keystone XL pipeline. Thanks for joining us, Steve Horn.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And you're tuned to WBAI in New York and WBAI.org. The preceding was Free Speech Radio News. Our next scheduled program will be Earthwatch with Robert Knight. Please stay tuned.
Forcibly.
I'm Harry Allen. This is Nonfiction. And Nonfiction is the magazine of the arts, ideas, and fact, airing every Friday, 2 to 3 p.m., over WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. Tune in for a wide range of compelling topics, informed guests, and penetrating interviews. That's Fridays, 2 to 3 p.m., Nonfiction, over WBAI New York and WBAI.org.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover.
This is Saul Williams.
And this is Michael Fried from Spearhead.
And this is WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York.
This is Reverend Jesse Jackson of the Rainbow Push Coalition. Please call and support WBAI, non-commercial peace and justice radio in New York.
And over WBAI New York and WBAI.org, we hear next Earthwatch with Robert Knight.
I'm Robert Knight, welcoming you to a very special edition of Earthwatch, covering the medical symposium at the New York Academy of Medicine, convened by Physicians for Social Responsibility co-founder, Dr. Helen Caldicott. In this program, we shall hear from Alexei Yablokov of the Russian Academy of Sciences on the relationship between Fukushima and Chernobyl. Also from Dr. Tim Musso, the professor of biological sciences at the University of South Carolina, on the biological consequences of Chernobyl, Fukushima, and other hot places. We begin the program with American sailors Maurice Innes and Jamie Plym. They both suffered horrendous radiation effects from exposure to the radioactive Fukushima plume on the aircraft carrier, the USS Ronald Reagan.
I'm introducing now the two U.S. Navy sailors, Quartermaster Maurice Innes and Jamie Plym, who both experienced this radiation exposure.
Hi everyone, my name is Jamie Plym. I'll just kind of give you a chronological timeline of what happened. We were already on deployment in 2011. We were about to pull into a routine port call in South Korea. We go to our navigation brief the night before we were going to pull in, and we found out that the tsunami and earthquake happened. Immediately we knew that we were going to reroute the ship to Japan to provide aid and, you know, give them food, water. So we did that immediately. We probably got to the coast of Japan probably the day after it happened. We never heard anything about a nuclear power plant. We never knew anything about the possibility, let alone any kind of leak. So we were there outside. Our job as quartermasters is not only navigating the ship, driving, plotting our course and track, but going outside at the top of the ship to raise flags to communicate with other ships. So being outside, we were breathing in this radiation. We were handling flags, which are porous, very porous material, obviously. The ropes that we use to haul the flags up are polyester, so again, a very porous material that just absorbed the radiation. We didn't really hear anything for probably a couple weeks after about a leak in the power plants. And even then, it was just still considered kind of a rumor. The ship didn't really even go on lockdown, which I mean by that, like no one was allowed outside, probably until about a month and a half after March 11th. So we were outside breathing this in, handling stuff, handling materials, and just absorbing the radiation. I'll let Maurice talk about his medical issues that he's encountered, but I'll talk about mine. We didn't finish that deployment until October 2011, so we carried on with our deployment. About halfway through, probably around the summertime, my menstrual cycle just disappeared completely. And then it would come back and disappear and go on and off. And this happened until about the summer of 2012, where it came back in such full force that I was in and out of the emergency room once they thought they were going to have to do a blood transfusion on me because I lost so much. I was still in the Navy for this past year. I got out this past January, 2013, so I was still getting Navy care for that year. I was already on the birth control pill, which I guess they would do to control that kind of menstrual cycle. So the only thing that they could do is say, this is called dysfunctional uterine bleeding, and we can give you an IUD with hormones in it. And so now that's what I have. It hasn't really stopped it. I still have this issue. And now I have to pay for the medical costs of that. In addition to that, in February 2012, I developed bronchitis. And then from February to the summer of 2012, I got it 6 times. I was sent to a respiratory doctor, and it was determined that I developed asthma. So a lot of people don't understand that once you get out of the Navy, you don't get any health care at all. If you retire and you stay in 20 years, you get health care. But we only did one enlistment. I did 5 years, he did four, so we don't get that unless it's a disability, a service-related disability, which dysfunctional uterine bleeding does not really count as a disability as of yet. So we're still fighting that case, and this is also what we're involved in the lawsuit against TEPCO for medical expenses that we're now having to, we're going to have to pay out of pocket for.
I'll speed it up because I know I don't have much time. I'll start with the beginning of my story where I received the radiation. A part of our job is we have to communicate with other ships using flags and semaphore and Morse code when we're doing special operations. And we store all our flags outside in a weather bag. We also fly our American flag or ensign at the highest point so people know we're the U.S. Navy. I was told by one of the higher-ups to go out and retrieve the American flag so we can give it to the Japanese as a friendship type of deal, like a gift. I pulled the flag down. It's flapping, went and wrapped around me. It got all over me. I folded it up. I took it down there. I gave it to them, and I'm not sure what they did with it, but I got off watch an hour later. I went to go get something to eat with one of my good friends. We stopped, I used the restroom, and we're just joking around because at the time there's still rumors going around about radiation being on the ship. And we're joking around about my growing extra fingers and toes and stuff like that. And we were like, let's stop and get checked for radiation, because they started setting up these little checkpoints all along the ship. And they were saying, it's just a precaution, you don't have nothing to worry about. If you get some free time, just go get checked out. And we're joking and laughing, walking over there, and he gets checked first, and nothing happens. He gets his hands checked, and nothing happens, and he's like smirking, like, I told you, this is just a waste of time. And I get my boots checked, my pants, and then my hands, and as soon as they get to my hands, the machine just goes crazy, and instantly, like, we went from, like, smiling to just being nervous and scared, and they instantly told everybody to back away from me. They made a perimeter around me. And they marched me to a decon station. The whole time they were telling everybody to stand fast, which means stay in your place and back up. And everybody's just looking and freaking out. And I had to hold my hands up, and I had bags on them. And they were telling everybody to contaminate, still everybody, just get back. And we make it to the decon station, and I see there's a huge pile of clothes there from other sailors, and I go in, and they had to remove three layers of skin off my hands and arms, and it wasn't like back-to-back. It was, they would scrub off one layer, and then I would have to wash off this orange grit stuff that you used to get off paint and oil, and then they would do it over again and then check, and we'd start the process all over. So in my head, I was just kind of praying that the machine would stop beeping so I can get it over with. Like, and nobody told me at the time, like, what was going on. Everybody just kind of told me just to stand there and be quiet and not to touch anybody or anything. It was almost like I had the plague. And finally, the machine stopped beeping, and they let me go back to my berthing. And that's when I got to my berthing. They called and asked me to come up on watch to relieve the people on watch, and they told me that I had received the highest amount of radiation out of anybody on the ship. And they told me that there was nothing they could do about it while we're out to sea, that we'd have to wait for us to pull in. And another lump appeared between my eyes. I have another lump on my right thigh. As soon as I got out of the military, I went back to college, and I started playing college sports again. And I actually ran within like 3 seconds of an Olympic time for my track and field team. And slowly after that, my body just started to fall apart. It's harder for me to breathe now. It feels a lot like my lungs are too big for my body whenever I do something like strenuous. I lost a lot of weight from the time I was in the Navy to now. I've got stomach ulcers. It doesn't look like it, but my hair's started to fall out. I try to avoid brushing and combing it, and I'll wash it like every 3 days, just because I don't. It's like Navy tradition. When you get out, you grow out your hair and you grow out your beard, and because you're bald for so long, and like it's just falling out now, and I don't want to speed that up. Like a little bit after we found out that the ship was radiated and we had finished up helping out, we left the area, and before we pulled into our first port since the disaster, we all had to sign this paperwork saying that the military is not to be held liable for anything that happened, and we had to sign paperwork saying that we weren't sick, that we were okay, and that they did tests on us. And it wasn't like a yes or no type of option. It was just like you have to sign it.
We pause momentarily to remind our listeners that this kind of public service programming is made possible only by listener donations to this non-commercial public radio station. WBAI is currently in the midst of an emergency fund drive to retain its invaluable transmitter atop the Empire State Building, where our signal reaches millions of listeners in the New York tri-state metropolitan region. We have merely a few days to complete our goal for the WBAI Emergency Transmitter Fund, and we now ask you to call our pledge center at area code 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. And pledge any amount, but hopefully $100 or more, to keep your radio station in operation. That's only a penny per hour for a year's worth of vital programming and public service. Once again, that's 516-620-3602 for the WBAI Emergency Transmitter Fund. Thank you for your generous support.
Before I even introduce myself, I think I have to also give a special a word of thank you to Dr. Helen Caldicott, who not only has put together with PSR this wonderful symposium and has been doing this for decades, but who personally got me involved in 1982 with these issues, and I've been working ever since. And my wife and my child and our futures depend upon this work, and I'm very grateful that Helen opened my eyes to this. So my name is Dr. Andy Cantor. I'm the immediate past president of Physicians for Social Responsibility of the National Board, as well as here in New York City, Physicians for Social Responsibility chapter. PSR is the largest physician-led organization that is dedicated to educating about and advocating to prevent this most gravest threats to human health and survival. And this includes nuclear weapons, climate change, toxic degradation of the environment. And full disclosure, PSR opposes nuclear power on several grounds, including the public health impact of the entire fuel cycle, the normal operations and accidents, and of course, the linkage with nuclear weapons. PSR has been working on these issues for over 50 years. What is clear, however, is that as a species, we have tended to choose expediency and short-term benefit over the longer-term responsibility to our ecosystem and to future generations. It used to be that it appeared that we had the luxury of doing what we wanted to satisfy our own needs for growth or development, or simply to satisfy our desires. We could take what we wanted and throw away anything we wanted to. And we just assumed that we would always have enough fuel or commodities or the great big ocean or the wide atmosphere would just swallow up our waste and our hubris. Now, in this Anthropocene age, we know that this is no longer true, and it never was true. We have failed to see the implications of our actions, and they have threatened not only our existence, but the very existence of life on this planet. So it is in this light that we must look at our choices for energy production. We must weigh carefully the risks and benefits, and we must seek to include all of the externalities. For nuclear power, this includes the medical and public health consequences of the entire fuel cycle, from the mining and enriching of the nuclear fuel, its transport, operations in the nuclear reactors, their inevitable accidents, and releases, and then the reprocessing, waste disposal, and the proliferation of fissile materials and production of nuclear weapons. It is no longer acceptable to continue with the status quo. We must shake loose the shackles of the old ways that have bound us to a course that will lead to our inevitable destruction, and do as Einstein demanded, adopt a new way of thinking if we are to survive. Now, I just returned from an actually exhilarating meeting in Oslo, Norway, where civil society, along with 132 countries of like-minded national governments, came together to discuss the catastrophic humanitarian consequences of nuclear weapons. This is going to be followed up by a meeting in Mexico City, because the status quo has led to insufficient progress on reducing the threat from nuclear weapons. And this new track, similar to the Ottawa landmines or Oslo cluster munitions processes, seeks to ban and eliminate nuclear weapons. Not as President Obama said, sometime in the future, but in my lifetime. It is essential for all of society to be educated on nuclear power and the nuclear fuel cycle if we are to advocate from truth and provide a prescription for a safe, healthy, and sustainable future. This morning, we have two excellent panels of experts who are going to discuss the accidents at Chernobyl and Fukushima and what this means for nuclear power in the United States and generally. And I'm hoping that this information, along with yesterday's fact-filled presentations, will help us guide policy and implications for the United States as well as the rest of the world. And now to get on with the panel, and you didn't come here to hear me speak, I'm going to introduce the first speaker, who we've already heard a great deal about already yesterday, Dr. Alexei Yablokov from the Russian Academy of Sciences, whose extensive collection of Chernobyl publications was recently published by the New York Academy of Sciences. Dr. Yablokov.
I am proud to be here and express my vision, my understanding of the Chernobyl situation. 24 years ago, it was Mikhail Gorbachev who asked me to chair the Committee of Ecology of Soviet Parliament. I was Soviet parliamentarian. I immediately understand that Chernobyl is the number one environmental catastrophe in Soviet Union. And later, Gorbachev accept that from Chernobyl, it was start to collapse of Soviet Union. Later, after collapse of Soviet Union, I was advisor to the Russian president. That time it was Boris Yeltsin, who also support my, not investigation, my not study, but my activity to dig the truth about Chernobyl. A short presentation is impossible to explain all detail. I tried it main problem. What such evolution of official point of view? Immediately after Chernobyl, in several months, in several days, all officials, international and national, Soviet Union, predict no immediate dangers, just absolutely the same like in Fukushima. No immediate dangers, it's like slogan. No elevation of cancer risk. Later, in several years, they accept that total death toll will be about 9,000 and number of sick about 200,000 for Chernobyl generation up to from 1986 to 2056. UN scare discuss not established but discuss incident of thyroid cancer, leukemia, solid cancer as whole, cardiovascular mortality, cataract, autoimmune system. It happened under our pressure when we published a lot of paper. All Chernobyl literature, scientific literature, I think about 30, maybe 35,000 published papers. It's impossible to review all of this paper in detail. I know about 5,000, maybe 6,000 of this paper. All this prediction based on invalid concept of average effective dose. What is my understanding now? It was dose conception. When we calculate any dose, it's a trick which profitable only for nuclear industry. How possible real estimate the dose during first day and week, when the level of irradiation after any nuclear catastrophe, 1,000, maybe 1,000,000 times higher than it happened in 1 month, in 2 months, it's impossible. How is possible to estimate consequences of hot particles? How it possible to patch contamination? Any contamination, radioactive contamination is patchy, spotted. It's impossible to calculate it exactly. How it possible to calculate dose from all radionuclide, not only from cesium, not only from strontium, but from many. Look for this picture. This is during the first day, first month, combination of radionuclide. It was about 60 or 70 different radionuclide. It was not cesium and not strontium who was the highest level of radiation during first day. Later, it changed this combination and so on and so on. How it possible to estimate influence of each radionuclide by dose conception? Impossible. Simple impossible. Look for this. This is a Greek, especially not for Russia, because for Russia, for Ukraine, for Belarus, we have 100 of such pictures, but it's Greek. Greek, and this is argentum. Look, not cesium, not strontium. Argentum.
Silver.
Yeah.
Silver.
Huh?
Silver.
Silver, sorry. Argentum is the Latin name. Yeah. This is cesium. So look, patchy, at patchiness from silver different from patchiness from cesium. How is it possible to correctly apply the average weighting coefficient for calculation of dose? All dose is not real data. It's calculation. It's calculation by some presumption. One of the presumption, you have average weight coefficient for skin, one coefficient for brain, other coefficient for lung, third coefficient, so. It's absolutely unrealistic. It looks like average temperature for hospital. Next big discrepancy for dose is average consumption. Average consumption for air, average consumption for water, average consumption for food is impossible. It's impossible. All dose calculations for Belarusian people based on real calculation for 1.1% people. It's absolutely non-representative. Maybe I remind that all data for DOS based on the uniform phantom means healthy white man, age 20 years. How many healthy white men among us, among people who are suffering from radiation, is zero, near to zero? Also, in Chernobyl, in Fukushima now, we have a lot of falsification. In Soviet Union, it was official secrecy up to 3.5 years after catastrophe. If we have special, we know document. One of these documents here, when Ministry of Public Health has special order to change the medical data. Never put in the record the truth about Chernobyl, about radiation consequences. How is it possible based on this data? Impossible. Main postulate of average effective dose concept contradicts a large volume of data. The individual effective equivalent dose is the main criteria for World Health Organization and other organizations could not be efficient for estimation of real level of irradiation of people. But what we what we can do? How obtain real information? We have data. We have such way. Morbidity of population. Having identical background, physical, environmental, and so, and difficult, and differ only in radioactive contaminated on its territory. And health of the same group of individuals, which study in different time after catastrophe, in 1 year, in 10 years, in 20 years, the same group of people. The health of the same individual in regard to disorders which connected, strongly connected only with irradiation, like stable chromosome aberration. So we have scientific approach to collect data. We have it. Nuclear scientists reject this approach, but I used it. It published... this book, Chernobyl Consequences, first time was published in St. Petersburg in year 2007. After this, it was published in New York, Academy of Science, and after this, it's published in Kyiv two years ago. And now, in one month, it will be published in Tokyo, in large edition. So I think it's the most up-to-date independent review of Chernobyl consequences. It's reflect, I think, about 5,000 papers, maybe 6,000 papers, but it give us the true picture. Several examples. Solid cancer incidence in the province which heavy contaminated at the upper curve. This is heavy contaminated province, Russian province, Bryansk province. This is less contaminated, and this is average for Russia. Visible, no other reason for such differences in cancer rate, only Chernobyl consequences. We don't know what exact radionuclide affect Bryansk province, but we have result. We have result. This is cancer dynamic of thyroid cancer morbidity after Chernobyl in Belarus and Ukraine. You can see all when we compare. When we compare a less contaminated and more contaminated area, immediately we have effect. Nobody explained this outside of Chernobyl. Only Chernobyl, nothing more. No reason for such a differences between populations. This is dynamic of thyroid cancer in Greece and Romania. The same. I also take this country outside of Soviet Union because we have a lot of data for Soviet Union, many. But even here we have papillary form of cancer much jumped after Chernobyl. No other explanation, only Chernobyl. Breast cancer, the same situation. The area with low level contamination have low level of cancer, and area with high level of contamination have a rising after in what is this in 10 years after Chernobyl jumped exactly is in the textbook. In 10 years after Chernobyl, this cancer has to arise. It will happen in Fukushima also. Absolutely, I am sure. This is an example of awful picture. We have several, I don't know, not exact data, but it's typical malformation. Professor Vertilevsky will be discussing it in detail, I hope, but we have such a huge, maybe several hundred every year additional such people. And this is lens opacity, it's not cataract. It's not cataract. Cataract accept, even nuclear scientists accepted cataract, yes, one of the reasons for irradiation is lens opacity. Look, what has happened, strong correlation between body burden, how many becquerel in body, and how many lens opacity in eye in children. This is prevalence of trisomia. Trisomia, Down syndrome, is a great similarity between West Berlin. Berlin is here, and this is Belarus. It's interesting approach, Sperling and Professor Sperling. Look, after Chernobyl, after jumped in Chernobyl, the level of these illnesses slightly differ from previous. It was, they called it stick, broken stick model. Broken stick model. It's interesting for many illnesses, the same situation. This is such a combination all data. What disorder we have with Chernobyl? Practically all system. Blood, endocrine, immune, urogenital tract, skeletal system, so on. Every system have some visible consequences after low level irradiation, which continue many years. Among consequences of Chernobyl, premature aging, even children became similar with some elder people. So it's aging. Mutation, of course, change of sex ratio. Sex ratio. Some German statistics calculate that about 1 million girl, less 1 million girl after Chernobyl consequences on the total world, on the globe. Officials and nuclearists usually insist that it's psychological factor, radiation phobia. Yesterday, Professor Musso very visible explained what is a psychological factor for barn swallow and some other animals. Continue. What radiation phobia for frogs, for pine tree, which we have this similar broken chromosome and so on. This is several examples. Very difficult to calculate miscarriage. The level of many journalists ask me what the consequences in Chernobyl in the death. How it calculate? Very difficult. First of all, miscarriage. A lot of miscarriage. Maybe 100,000 miscarriage all over the globe was after Chernobyl. The same situation in Fukushima. I am sure. Look for this, it's deviant for infant mortality. It's just statistical data, it's nothing more. What we can see the jump after Chernobyl catastrophe, some jumped in infant mortality. This is Germany and this is Poland, but we have the same data for any country. I ask Alfred Korblein is a wonderful statistician from Germany, from München, collect data for me. He immediately he take the statistical, official statistical data. Look for this. This is Switzerland. After Chernobyl, unexplained level of rising of child mortality. The same in Finland. The same for any European country. The same. No explanation, only Chernobyl. Look for this latest data for Fukushima. I know that Jan Farley will be, after me, will be detailed discuss the situation. I just show this. After the same, like in, after Chernobyl, we have here jumped, unusual, statistically detectable, jumped in infant mortality for all Japanese population, for all Japanese population, not for vicinity of Fukushima, but for all. If we study vicinity of Fukushima, it will be more visible absolutely. Some St. Petersburg statistician tried to collect data about mortality in heavy contaminated area, heavy contaminated after Chernobyl. This is heavy contaminated 6 Russian province and less contaminated situated near to heavy contaminated. Differences, you see statistically very strong differences. The data after 15 years, it looked like 4% additional death rate, 4%. This is similar data I catch from Ukraine and from Belarus, 4 and 3 and 7%, something about 4%. For the first 15 years after Chernobyl, the total mortality decreased in heavy contaminated area, like in Fukushima, for 4%. It means if we calculate it more and more for all of Chernobyl fallout. By the way, bulk of Chernobyl fallout go away from Soviet Union. Soviet Union received only about 40% of Chernobyl radionuclide. 60% received Europe, Africa, Asia, even United States. So if you calculate step by step, it looks like about Chernobyl death toll for 15 years, about 800,000. Many nuclear scientists blame me for this data. I ask them, please show me where my calculation is wrong. No one never show me some mistake in my calculation. No, the same. If all animals, plant and microorganism have the height level of change in contaminated area, it's impossible to say about phobia and psychological factor and something else. No, the same. The main Chernobyl lesson: the nuclear industry. There is the same risk to our planet with nuclear power, not only theoretically, but practically, in the same level risk for humanity and the Earth at whole as a nuclear weapon. Thank you very much.
Спасибо большое. Really nice to hear things that we don't often hear because of our language or geography. I think it was very important also to come back to a message that came from yesterday as well, which Dr. Yablokov alluded to, which is that the results depend on the assumptions. And if the assumptions do not include all of the known data, you will get erroneous results.
Was it Friday, April 1986? And the day that the nightmare began, when the dolls rained down on our building and streets, it entered our bedrooms at noon. Touched the soil and the trees, our bikes and our cars, our pens, books and picture frames too. As we stood around all helpless, confused, nobody knew what to do. But by 2 o'clock Sunday, the buses arrived, a fleet of 1,000 or more. And we were ordered to be on our way, not knowing what lay in store. Some of our citizens fled in dismay, and looked for a good place to hide. When 4 o'clock came and the last bus pulled out, was the day our lovely town died. And the shirt sheets and handkerchiefs cracked in the wind, on the windows lay out of plans. The ladders and the valves are parked by the door, and the bikes in its usual stands. Our evergreen trees lie withered and drooped, for they poisoned our fertile land. And our streets speak a deafening silence, nothing now stirs but the sand. The mementos we gathered, they were all left behind, of photos and letters and cards. The toys of our children lay untouchable now, toy soldiers were standing on guard. A village uprooted and planted elsewhere, each severed branch searing pain. The dolls from the past wiped clean from the slate, yet fearful it might come again. And the shirt sheets and handkerchiefs crack in the wind, on the windows I all weather plans. The ladders and the boulders are parked by the door, and the bikes in its usual stand. Our evergreen trees lie withered and drooped, for they poisoned our fertile land. And our streets speak a deafening silence, nothing now stirs but the sun. Like a mother in Pompeii and you, to see all the old shops and the forest hotel and the prom yet cinema too. The couch grass and the weeds they push through the cracks, defiant despite man's best ploys. And experiments flourish in this paradise lost, with no pulse beat or no children's cries. So fare thee well, Pripyat, my home, my soul, or your sorrow can know no release. It's a terrifying glimpse of the future you show, as your children lie scattered like these. The clothesline still sways, but the honor's long gone, as the nomadic era returns. The questions in black and white blurred into grey, the answers too easy to learn. And the short sheets and handkerchiefs crack in the wind, on the window fly all over flat. The ladders and the valves are parked by the door, and the bikes in its usual stands. Our evergreen trees lie withered, for they poisoned our fertile land. And our streets speak a deafening silence, nothing now stirs but the sun, burning sun. Oh, nothing stirs. for the sun.
This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight, and you're tuned to WBAI New York, broadcasting at 99.5 megahertz FM, which we could soon be deprived of without your urgently needed support for the WBAI Emergency Transmitter Fund. Please take a moment now to call our 24-hour pledge line at area code 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602, and make a tax-deductible pledge in any amount, but hopefully $100 or more, to preserve, protect, and defend Earthwatch and all of the other fine, informative, and cultural programs upon which we all depend. That's 516-620-3602, or donate online at give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. This is Earthwatch on WBAI New York. I'm Robert Knight, and we now continue our special coverage of the Fukushima Medical Symposium convened at the New York Academy of Medicine by Dr. Helen Caldicott. Up next is Dr. Alexei Yablokov of the Russian Academy of Sciences, examining Fukushima in the context of lessons learned from Chernobyl.
Let me start by thanking Helen and Mally and PSR for organizing and hosting this event. It's really wonderful to be here. It's a fantastic opportunity. And surprisingly, I think, well, maybe not surprisingly, this really is the biggest event of this sort, I think, around the world today. I think this really is the main event, so count yourself lucky to be here.
You need to speak further in the mic.
Oh, sorry. There we go. Sorry about that. I'm used to screaming and yelling to a group of students, so I'm not used to talking into a microphone like this. Anyway, I've been working in Chernobyl with my colleagues for about 13 years now, and this first slide really here is to remind me to acknowledge the many partners, some of the key partners that we've had over the years, especially Anders Møller, who's been my main collaborator and partner since the very beginning. What you may notice from this list of co-authors is that there are no Japanese names on that list. And I did want to make the point that we've had many very important Japanese collaborators, but who would rather not be named in most of this work. Our first publication, we had a long list of our collaborators. The second publication, we were missing three of them. And the latest publication, all but one of our half a dozen colleagues really didn't want to be have their name publicly associated with the work. It was not that they don't want to help us. They've been very, very helpful, but they were concerned about the long-term impacts. The other thing I wanted to mention, point out in this slide, are our sponsors, of course, especially the Samuel Freeman Charitable Trust, who have been very supportive of this work over the years. Right, so a number of years ago, prior to 311, we started our work just by chance into the impacts of radioactive contaminants in Chernobyl, and it really was an interest driven by evolutionary genetics, evolutionary biology, not radioecology, not nuclear medicine, not anti-nuclear activism in any way. And we started our work with birds, primarily because they're easy to see, they're easy to catch, they're easy to identify, they're easy to count. And some of them you can even track throughout their lifespan. And because they can't see, smell, or even heard about the radiation per se, they're not put off by the fence around Chernobyl. So they come in when they do. We can follow them. And we can track their lives in the very most highest contaminated areas. And this gives us a lot more resolution, a lot more power to conduct studies of the long-term health impacts, at least if you're a bird or a bug, of these contaminants. And of course, following 311, we've changed the name of our group to the Chernobyl Plus Fukushima Research Initiative. I don't expect you to read this slide. It's actually just a list of the 50 or so publications that we've generated in the last 7 or 8 years. And really all this to show you is that we've been busy. And because I know my time up here is rather short, I'm going to start backwards in my talk. I'm going to start with the conclusions, and then we'll move backwards through some of the supporting information just for fun. And so the major findings, after working in Chernobyl since 2000 and Fukushima since July of 2011, and we can say most of this from Chernobyl though, most organisms that have been looked at in any detail show significantly increased rates of genetic damage in direct proportion to the level of exposure to radioactive contaminants. We have a couple of papers on this topic. I'd be happy to point you to them. We've reviewed the literature, as have others, and it's overwhelming. Most organisms living in these areas show increased rates of deformities, developmental abnormalities, some of them you might even call tumors or cancers, in direct proportion to the contamination levels that they're living in. Because these are animals and plants and things like that, they don't move too much far usually. Most of the organisms that we've looked at show reduced fertility rates. In terms of the male birds, about 40% of the male birds in the more contaminated parts of Chernobyl are completely sterile. They have no sperm. And we've looked. I'm not going to show you how we've looked, but we've looked very hard. And 40% of the males have either no sperm or just a few dead sperm when we take the samples. Most of them that we've been able to measure have reduced lifespans. And as a consequence of the reduced fertilities and reduced lifespans, most of these species, most of these populations, have smaller sizes, reduced growth rates. The numbers of individuals in most of these groups are lower in the more contaminated areas of Chernobyl. And as a consequence of this, many of these species have actually gone locally extinct in the more contaminated areas. So biodiversity has been affected. The last two points are a little more speculative and they're a little bit more based on indirect evidence. They're hard to test directly, but I think our indirect evidence is pretty strong, especially now that we can compare the findings from Chernobyl to those that we're seeing in Fukushima, and we hope to compare Fukushima and Chernobyl to other naturally hot places around the world. The first is that it's very clear in Chernobyl, ironically, because the radiation levels are so low, because they're low enough that organisms don't drop dead immediately as a result of exposure, they live long enough, some of them live long enough, to accumulate mutations and to pass them on to the next generation. And these will accumulate over multiple generations. This is our hypothesis. I think the data we have is strongly supportive of that. And we're not the first ones to suggest this, of course. There are no original ideas in science. The last point here, which is also equally interesting, I think, is that, again, because this isn't a black hole in its entirety, some of these individuals live long enough to reproduce, to pass, to migrate out of the area. The younger the year, some of them will migrate out, carrying the mutations that they've accumulated. So we see the effects of mutations in populations that have never seen radiation per se. And so I think, from my perspective, as an evolutionary biologist, those are two important points. Most of our work has been done on animal models. And in some ways this has been good because it's allowed us to sort of pass through some of the gates and barriers that have been erected for people who study human populations. And if you're working on birds and bees, you don't get taken too seriously for the most part. So you can do things that other people can't do. But also, perhaps, birds don't drink or smoke or get depressed, as far as I can tell. Maybe there's a few male birds who get depressed about not finding a girlfriend, but for the most part, we don't have to worry about some of the environmental issues that have been suggested as important for some of the effects that we see in the human populations, alcoholism in particular, and drinking. And, you know, the sorts of questions we ask, again, as we're just biologists, so, you know, we ask, can we measure mutation rates in these natural populations? Does it relate to the radiation levels, contamination levels? Are there any consequences to the mutations? We all carry around lots of mutations inside our bodies. Most of them are never expressed. Most of them have no effect. So, you know, quite conceivably, the levels that we're talking about, maybe they induce extra mutations, but they don't matter because there are no expressed consequences. So we need to test for that. Are there deformities? Are there neurological developmental effects? These kinds of things. Of course, you know, all of us are different in this room. Some of those differences are the result of mutations. Most of them don't matter. It probably doesn't matter too much that I'm missing a little hair here as a result of some mutation. And it's probably not influencing my survival or ability to reproduce. And so, you know, a lot of these mutations, even if they're expressed, don't really influence survival or reproduction or adaptation. And so we need to get at that. Doesn't matter. And finally, population sizes and ecosystem consequences. All right, so here's where we're a little different than most people. This is sort of the schematic of the approach that we've taken. It's kind of unique, and I really have to give a lot of credit to my collaborator Anders Mahler for really pushing this. And basically, what we do. So the world is, you know, the natural world is a complicated, heterogeneous place. Even in New York City, every corner is a little bit different with respect to the amount of sunlight, the micro temperature, the amount of rainfall, the sorts of other plants that are there, the other bird species that might be flying in. Every point in space and time is unique. And so how do you factor out that variability to ask simply the simple question of, or not so simple question of, what is the effect of radioactivity or radioactive contaminants on an individual, a population, a species? And the way we've done this, got at this kind of question, is to employ what I call a massively replicated biotic inventory design. It's a long word. Basically, we go to as many places as we can squeeze into a short period of time, and we count every last organism that we see in these different locations. So in the case of Fukushima, we've made 700 of these inventories in the last 2 years. In the case of Chernobyl, we stopped at 896 because it takes a long time to do these things. But we go to a spot and we measure everything, the numbers of birds, the species of birds, the numbers of insects, the numbers of spiders, whatever is possible. And we also measure all of the environmental variables that might be of relevance in terms of determining the presence or absence and abundance of a given group of organisms. So the meteorology, the hydrology, the geology, the community of plants, is there water around? What kind of plant species are there? That kind of thing. And then we, of course, measure the radiation level too, right? For the most part, we've used very simple measures of radiation level. We've learned that that actually captures most of the heterogeneity in radiation just by using a simple Geiger counter. That's certainly a good proxy for most of the sorts of things that we're looking at as we've learned in the last year. We throw this into a GIS kind of model, Geographic Information System kind of model, employ some fancy multivariate statistics, but nothing so fancy that anyone in this room probably could learn to use them, to generate predictive models of radiation effects on populations. So when we do this, we can get at the partial effects of the radioactive contaminants on natural populations. It's worked pretty well. And so here you can see our areas of Belarus and Ukraine. This actually doesn't show all of the sites, but they're throughout these areas. Inside the exclusion zone, outside the exclusion zone, 896 surveys to date. Here's Japan, Fukushima. This is the general area that we've been to. Tokyo's down here, of course. Koriyama, 300,000 people. Fukushima City, 300,000 people. Here's the area of highest contamination. Here's a closer
view of the areas that we've been sampling from. You'll note that we have not managed to get to this area here of highest contamination, despite our best efforts. Last summer, we did manage to get inside, you know, the 20-kilometer zone and to some areas that were on the order of 100 microsieverts per hour. So a good solid range. The trouble actually in Fukushima isn't finding hot spots. The trouble is finding cold spots to compare them to. And we have spent way more time looking for control areas with minimal contamination than we have looking for the hot areas. And I think that's informative. The first way we get this information is to do biotic inventories, where we just basically look and count everything. Another way is to set up nets for the birds. We set up about half a kilometer of nets. Anybody recognize? I'm sure you can recognize this guy, but anybody know this guy? Yeah, Jeremy Wade, the River Monsters. They're doing a show on Chernobyl called The Atomic Assassin. But anyway, they were out to see how we caught birds. And unfortunately, this video doesn't work, but this is just to show you that we do catch birds. And we get blood samples, we get feather samples, we measure everything that's possible to be measured on a bird in a relatively short period of time. This is actually a lot of fun, because we get to handle the birds. We also get sperm from the males, if they have any. And we don't hurt birds. We do release all the birds. We don't engage in destructive sampling at all. So that's how we catch the birds and get bird data. How do we measure radiation? Well, we do it a number of ways. In the good old days, we just took our Geiger counter. In the last few years, we've gotten a little more sophisticated, and we've taken our radionuclide identifier system into the field, and this will actually give us, not only will it give us the radiation level, but it'll also tell us what's accounting for the radiation in given areas, which is interesting. So this is a $15,000 Geiger counter, essentially, but very, very useful. We can take the same instrument. Well, another way that we look at radiation dosage these days is we can take little TLDs. These are tiny little crystal chips that capture radiation that we can then return to the lab and read how much external radiation and what the external dose that this bird has actually gotten. By taking this TLD, putting it on a bird beam, putting it on the bird, releasing the bird, then recapturing the bird, we can get a pretty good idea of how much radiation they're actually getting. The first bird there was actually my pet bird, who was the guinea pig for this system. And you can't see this because it's too dark and it's too bright, both at the same time. This is a barn swallow, again showing one of the TLDs here. Can you see that at all? It's just washed out. Yeah. Anyway, but you could see it here, right? You can see this little package here, which has basically got this. Anyway, and then the last way that we measure radiation actually is to take birds, put them in a special lead cave in the field without hurting them, and measure their whole body burden. And this has just given us a lot of information. You get these little spectra that look like that. And it turns out that we now know that there's actually a very good relationship between our simple Geiger surveys to date. Here's Japan, Fukushima. This is the general area that we've been to. Tokyo's down here, of course. Koriyama, 300,000 people. Fukushima City, 300,000 people. Here's the area of highest contamination. Here's a closer view of the areas that we've been sampling from. You'll note that we have not managed to get to this area here of highest contamination, despite our best efforts. Last summer, we did manage to get inside, the 20-kilometer zone and to some areas that were on the order of 100 microsieverts per hour. So a good solid range. The trouble actually in Fukushima isn't finding hot spots. The trouble is finding cold spots to compare them to. And we have spent way more time looking for control areas with minimal contamination than we have looking for the hot areas. And I think that's informative. The first way we get this information is to do biotic inventories, where we just basically look and count everything. Another way is to set up nets for the birds. We set up about half a kilometer of nets. Anybody recognize? I'm sure you can recognize this guy, but anybody know this guy? Yeah, Jeremy Wade, the River Monsters. They're doing a show on Chernobyl called The Atomic Assassin. But anyway, they were out to see how we count birds. And unfortunately, this video doesn't work, but this is just to show you that we do catch birds. And we get blood samples, we get feather samples, we measure everything that's possible to be measured on a bird in a relatively short period of time. This is actually a lot of fun because we get to handle the birds. We also get sperm from the males, if they have any. And we don't hurt the birds. We do release all the birds. We don't engage in destructive sampling at all. So that's how we catch the birds and get bird data. How do we measure radiation? Well, we do it a number of ways. In the good old days, we just took our Geiger counter. In the last few years, we've gotten a little more sophisticated, and we've taken our radionuclide identifier system into the field, and this will actually give us, not only will it give us the radiation level, but it'll also tell us what's accounting for the radiation in the given areas, which is interesting. So this is a $15,000 Geiger counter, essentially, but very, very useful. We can take the same instrument. Well, another way that we look at radiation like dosage these days is we can take little TLDs. These are tiny little crystal chips that capture radiation that we can then return to the lab and read how much external radiation and what the external dose that this bird has actually gotten by taking this TLD, putting it on a bird band, putting it on the bird, releasing the bird, then recapturing the bird. We can get a pretty good idea of how much radiation they're actually getting. The first bird there was actually my pet bird, who was the guinea pig for this system. And you can't see this because it's too dark and it's too bright, both at the same time. This is a barn swallow, again showing one of the TLDs here. Can you see that at all? It's just washed out. Yeah. Anyway, but you could see it here, right? You can see this little package here, which has basically got this. Anyway, and then the last way that we measure radiation actually is to take birds, put them in a special lead cave in the field without hurting them, and measure their whole body burden. And this has just given us a lot of information. We get these little spectra that look like that. And it turns out that we now know that there's actually a very good relationship between our simple Geiger counter measures of background radiation and the place that we catch the bird and how much radiation they're experiencing both externally and internally. And I'm just going to zoom ahead because I do want to get to some real data shortly. All right, so undoubtedly a few of you in this room have heard these stories, right? The Chernobyl zone is this thriving Eden for wildlife. Who hasn't heard that story? You have heard it, yeah. Yeah, it's just, you haven't heard that story? Oh, okay. Oh, okay. it drives me crazy because it's been perpetuated by primarily a few journalists and a few unscrupulous sorts. And it probably is the result of this statement generated by the Chernobyl Forum a few years ago, who suggested that the populations of many plants and animals have expanded and the present environmental conditions have been a positive impact on the biota of the Chernobyl exclusion zone. And they've also suggested that most of the human morbidity is a result of stress, right? But the truth is, at the time this report was written, there were no studies of biodiversity and abundance in the Chernobyl zone. None. So how could they come to this conclusion in the absence of data? Well, of course, that's the way it's done, right? The absence of data is used to support the notion that there are no effects. Yeah, anyway. So we decided to use that as our call to action, and we went out and started counting all the critters as we did. There's a few critters in the zone. These are my favorite, the Chvalsky's horses, beautiful horses that were introduced into the zone. They were actually they were extinct in the wild, except for and kept in a few zoo reserves. They were introduced into the Chernobyl zone because they thought this would be a nice place for them to live. Let's get an endangered species and put it in the most radioactive place on the planet. Yeah, okay. But, you know, there's been these, again, there's these reports. There was an article published in Slate magazine a few weeks ago. A former employee of mine, in fact, who's taken a few photos. He's been working there since 1986, and he's managed to capture a half a dozen decent photos of wildlife in the area. And, and so he's published a few of these pictures. Here's some wild boar. Here's some eagle. Here's an elk or something. And there are some critters in the zone. It's absolutely true. But I want you to see this map. Now, you have to be able to see this map, right? So this is an outline of the Chernobyl zone. And I want you to see, here's the power plant. And the darker colors are the hotter areas. And what I want you to note is that there are vast areas of the Chernobyl zone that are absolutely pristine with respect to radioactive contamination, and now there's no people there, too. So it's a very heterogeneous place. And so, as it turns out, that if you go to these clean areas, and in fact, this clean area right here is half the background radiation to Central Park. Central Park out here in New York is about 0.1 microsieverts per hour. This is about 0.05 in the cleanest parts of the Chernobyl zone. So to suggest, anyway, I think you get the idea. It's just, yes, you will see the occasional animal inside the zone just because it is a nice, clean place. It's a happy place. Anyway, but we decided to test this more directly because it actually doesn't matter if there are more animals inside the zone or not compared to outside. That avoids the main question. The main question is there an impact of the radioactive contaminants on these individuals and populations and species? That's the main question, not whether or not a fence keeps hunting out and allows some species to do better. So anyway, so we started counting them, and here's our first result. And this is the abundance of birds. I apologize for graphs, I can't help it. We have to use the abundance, the total numbers of birds. When you factor out all of these other things that can be, that are associated with variation in bird numbers, and just look at the effects of radiation of the contaminants, there's only about a third as many birds as there should be in these radioactive areas, highly radioactive areas. And there's only half as many species because, again, some of the numbers are so low that they're not sustaining populations of a given species. So biodiversity is depressed by about half in these birds. When we first published this paper, some of the folks said, well, you know, birds, they're hypersensitive to everything. You know, the canaries in the coal mine, right? You know, they're you can't be thinking about just birds. And so we said, okay, we'll do something else. So we started counting the insects because actually we had noticed that it was really hard to find some of the insects, and so anecdotally. So we decided to count them, and sure enough, one of the most notable things is an absence of bumblebees in these most contaminated areas. And some of you have heard about the reports that in Japan, mutant butterflies. It's true. Butterflies also appear to be hypersensitive to these contaminants, or hypersensitive. As a group, they seem to be much more sensitive than some of the other insect species. And very, very few butterflies in these most contaminated areas. Very few spiders, which is actually kind of pleasant because as you're doing work in the field, you don't have to worry about cobwebs hitting your face if you're an outdoorsy person. So one of the things I hate about doing field work is cobwebs. Don't have to worry about cobwebs in Chernobyl. Many fewer grasshoppers, many fewer dragonflies. But of course, then the response you get is, well, insects, who cares about insects? They're just bugs. What we care about are mammals, right? Because we're a mammal. And it took us a long time to figure out a way that we could sample the mammals, work with the mammals, because they're not easy to work with. They're smart, they tend to be nocturnal, many of them are subterranean, at least part of the time. They're just hard to do basic science with. So then it dawned on us, let's go back in the winter and look at snow prints in the snow. Anybody know what this print is? It's a wolf, yeah. So there are a few wolves in the Chernobyl zone, but mostly they're dogs. So we counted all the mammals and found the same basic relationship, many fewer mammals in the more contaminated areas. 2 years ago, we invited a group from Finland to come do some trapping, focusing on small mammals. There have been a couple of folks in the U.S., for instance, who've been suggesting Musso and Mueller are wrong. We've been studying mammals, small mammals, for 15 years, and we see no effects. You know, there's no mutations, there's no effect on samples, on abundances. So we brought some independent folks who aren't connected with Department of Energy or any of these other organizations to trap the heck out of the mice, and we found the same basic pattern. Many fewer of these small rodents, big impacts on reproduction. So in fact, now when visitors come to the Chernobyl zone, you know, you've heard about all the tourism. The Ukrainian government has been trying to make money by busing in tourists to see the reactor. And of course, many of these tourists come because they've heard that there's a lot of wildlife that they can get pictures of. And of course, they come in and there's nothing to be seen. It's, you know, it's very, very rare to see anything of significance. And so they set up a petting zoo in the town of Chernobyl. This is a BBC reporter trying to get her pictures of the wild animals of Chernobyl. So I think we've managed to convince a few people at least that actually Chernobyl is not this wildlife haven as suggested by the Chernobyl Forum. We've repeated this work in Fukushima, first in July 2011, then in July 2012, and as long as they allow us back into the country, we'll be back there in July 2013. Again, at 400 discrete locations to do our biotic inventories. We've also been working with barn swallows and barn swallow nests. What do we find? Well, with respect to the birds, we're finding the same basic overall pattern with respect to significantly reduced numbers of individuals in the more contaminated areas. It took us a couple of seasons to convince some of our local Japanese colleagues to really listen carefully, but it's a very silent place in most of these highly contaminated areas. Many fewer birds, many fewer insects, and it just smacks you in the face if you're paying attention. But anyway, strong effects. They're actually stronger in Fukushima. There were 14 species of birds where we could do direct comparisons between Chernobyl and Fukushima, and the relationship between radiation and abundance was twice as strong in Fukushima this first year as it is in Chernobyl, implying that perhaps there's a lack of resistance or there's an increased radio sensitivity in this naive population. Perhaps Chernobyl birds have evolved resistance to some degree, or just the ones that are susceptible have been weeded out already over the last 26 years. We don't really know the answer to that, but we're hoping to get to it. I've only got a few more minutes here, but if you, and again, you probably can't see this very well, but maybe you can. Chernobyl, basically every group that we've looked at show declines in the more highly contaminated areas. In Fukushima, the first year, we just basically saw, you know, bird abundance and biodiversity. Butterflies were dramatically impacted, negatively impacted, as were cicadas, which aren't found in Chernobyl, so there's no comparison. But the other groups of insects were not negatively affected, as best we could tell, and spiders actually went up in numbers in the more contaminated areas. Anybody have any ideas why spiders might go up? Why would spiders go up? Excellent. Bioecology 101, that's great. There's no birds around. So, you know, the main cause of spider mortality are birds. And so that's our suggestion. The second year, we've just finished the second year analysis, and it turns out that the effects are getting stronger. This is just a plot showing year-to-year change in the slope of the relationship between radiation and abundance, and the slopes are generally more negative in the second year than the first year. We'll see what happens this coming year. I just want to show a couple more slides. Because I don't want to eat into my colleague's time too much here, but so we know that population effects are significant. Are there developmental abnormalities? And I need to show just a couple slides because there's some pretty pictures, or not so pretty pictures. But we don't see any Godzillas or King Kongs, of course. But what we do see are very strangely anomalous organisms, including, you know, birds with very strange color patterns. So here's a barn swallow here. He's a partial albino. Here's a better view of sorts of strange color patterns. Again, not enough to kill any bird, but this bird, this is a male bird, and you can bet that this will influence his reproductive success. Girls don't like this. Girl birds don't like this color pattern. Interestingly enough, I just got this photo by email from the Japan Wild Bird Association just the other day. And this is from Minamisoma, which is a little town just north of the reactor on the coast. And I don't know if you can see this. See these little patches of white feathers here? This is where we started first seeing anomalies in Chernobyl. And so I was shocked, surprised, well, maybe I shouldn't have been, but I was surprised that they would capture these photos and send them to me. So we're starting to see some consequences potentially. We need to go back and verify that this is real. But we see all sorts of strange abnormalities, tumors on the beaks, strange growths on the beaks, strange missing patches of skin. And let me just skip ahead a little bit. Tumors around the eye are really quite common. Here's a tumor over on the side of the head. Another patches of white feathers where there shouldn't be white feathers. Strange growths on their feet, tumors on their wings, a close-up, strange growths around their rear ends. Just never been seen anywhere else in any great abundance, and they're much more common in areas of high contamination. Their brains are smaller. The neurological development's clearly impacted as a consequence of the contamination in direct proportion. And not only that, if they have smaller brains, they clearly have reduced cognitive function because they're much less likely to survive to the next year with these smaller brains. The trees are deformed. Here's a, you know, Christmas tree looking, you know, Pinus sylvestris, which is normally tall and straight, like a loblolly or a longleaf pine with a single trunk. Here are some other images of the deformed trees that you see all over the place. Some of this is the result of mutations. Some of this is the result of ongoing radiotoxicity from the cesium in the environment. Here's a firebug. Somebody mentioned Claudia, Cornelia Hesse Honegger, the Swiss artist who first started to document these abnormal insects around nuclear power plants in Europe. Here's the firebug. This is one of the bugs she first documented. And here is a collection of our Chernobyl firebugs. And if you think of these as being sort of African face mask-like things, it's really easy to see the abnormalities. Very, very unusual patterns. Again, highly correlated to background radiation levels. We got a paper coming out in the next few weeks, maybe a month, showing that the birds in Chernobyl have much higher rates of cataracts. Again, another trait associated with ionizing radiation. And as I mentioned before, fertility rates are dramatically impacted with many of the birds having no sperm. So I think I could go on and on and on and on and on, and I won't. And let me just finish again with the beginning again. So why has it been so easy? Apparently easy. It's not been easy in the sense I've had to eat a lot of Russian food. But why has it been so easy for us to go in and document one response after the next? They slap you in the face. They're so easy to find. It really hasn't taken a genius to make these observations. They're there. And the answer is, of course, that nobody has looked. Or if they've looked, they haven't followed through to compile the data and to analyze it properly and then to finally, you know, publish it. Why is that? Why haven't they done this? Vladimir, why haven't they done this? Yes, sir. That's what I'm thinking. They don't want to know the answer to these questions. And so how are they avoiding finding the answers? They just don't pay for research in this area. So they don't fund it. Yeah. So with that, I think I will step down and pass the podium on. Thank you very much.
I want to pay homage to Tim Rousseau, who with his colleagues is actually endangering his life by going into extremely high radioactive areas, doing pioneering work which is going to change the concept of radiation exposure to humans. And as you know, we physicians always test drugs and other things upon animals before we extrapolate and use them on human beings. What is happening to the animals, the insects, and the plants is going to happen to us. Only we take a long time to reproduce. Certainly in Sweden, they've shown that babies in utero at the time of Chernobyl have lower than normal IQs because the developing brain is very sensitive to radiation. That's reproduced in Tim's work. Extremely important work.
That was Dr. Helen Caldicott, convener of the Medical Symposium on the Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Disaster. This is Earthwatch, and I'm Robert Knight, thanking you for your support for WBAI with continuing emergency donations for the WBAI Transmitter Fund at our pledge line at 516-620-3602 or online at give2wbai.org. We also welcome your comments with an email to rknight@wbai.org. That's rknight@wbai.org. Now, please stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jung Freund. I'm Robert Knight for Earthwatch.
Pardon me. You're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. I am looking for my theme music on the computer here.
It was just there.
It was, oh, if you saw it?
Yeah.
You saw it with an H?
Hour? H-O-T something. Hot Wolf.
Hot, yeah, H-O-T-W is what I usually use, but I had it spelled out as Hour of the Wolf.
Well, whatever folder you were just in, it was there.
Maybe it's under my, it used to be under my documents. Oh, you know what? I bet I've got one on my flash drive that I just plugged in. So, which I just minimized, like the fool that I am, it'll be one of these. Here we are. Kingston.
Oh, that's what
H-O-T-W. Okay, that's it.
I told you it was there.
Yeah. So, one second. Pardon me. Let me warm up.
Earthwatch with Robert Knight was brought to you with Portions on recording. Okay, that done. Where are we? This is a very, very tight show because I've got this great interview and... Okay, there we go. I've got this great interview for you and I've got this... we have to survive. It's this little, this weird idea that we have that WBAI must survive, and that is in question. So we're going to have to talk about that a little, okay? So we're going to do both of those this morning. So you just bear with us, and you're going to hear Ken Liu, and you're going to say, okay, it was worth it. It was worth listening to that. But first, let's howl. That's if I brought the right pot up. Huh? Oh, good. It's scanning my file before it plays it. Here we go. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Ken Liu, L-I-U is the last name, is a remarkable, brilliant science fiction writer, and I recorded an interview with him just a week and some hours ago. You will hear that. Stay tuned. Okay, let me explain the deal. Oh, why not leave the silent running music on in the background? I chose the long mix. We have 90 minutes. I'm here until 3 a.m. And what I have is 70 minutes of recorded material. So, given intro music and outro music and all that, we gotta raise some money. Okay, let me explain. I mentioned this in my pre-recorded show last week. This is not pre-recorded. This is most live. But here's the deal. WBAI, first we moved out of, with our tail between our legs, we moved out of 120 Wall Street. We're now housed in the basement of CCNY, sharing space with WHCR, who's been a really conducive, nice host to us, nice people around here. And but our facilities are bare bones. I mean, when I started working for the station in 1967 in a brownstone, we had way more space and equipment than we've got now. And that was pretty bare bones already. So this is as meager as WBAI has ever been. But wait, there's more. Or should I say, there's less. Aside from the $33,000 or so that we spent on monthly rent, which is now, you know, something to like $5,000, that's only one thing. A fixed cost is the transmitter room. If we don't have a transmitter, we're not broadcasting. It's very simple. And the transmitter is, what is it, Max? About 50 a month?
Yep.
Yeah, it's about 50.
This year, we can go up to 60 next year.
Great. Okay. So, and right now, wait, don't go away. I just need confirmation of the numbers. We had to make, and I believe we have made it in pledges, $50,000 by March 15th.
Yes, that I think we got.
I believe we got 85.
It's the other $450,000 that they want by the end of the month. That's
not 450.
Yes, 450.
Wait, 450?
Yes.
By the end of this month?
They're looking for $500,000. Not just for the transmitter.
Oh, okay. The station. Oh, that's payroll and all those minor things.
And making up for the incredibly poor fund drive that we had.
Yeah. Which, and the poor fund drives, you know, and this is, now, you know, we should have a regular fundraising show called Blood from the Turnip. And, you know, I know that's what we're asking you, the listener, to do, you know, Blood from the Turnip. I know that the solution to making money when fund drives don't work is to hold yet more fund drives. That's somehow, you know, the idea of having more fund drives is counterintuitive. But right now, we have to make this amazing goal. I mean, if we don't make, what is it, $150,000 by March 31st, right?
Yes, but then on April 1st, they want April 50,000.
That's
so,
right.
So we really need 200,000.
Okay, so
just
we,
for the transmitter.
So just to stay on the air, never mind payroll. You know,
hey, wait a second. I resent that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're actually on staff. I'm unpaid staff. But to make the payroll, to pay the people like Max, that and Sydney who are here, who operate WBAI, to pay for other capital expenses that we have. Max said we need $500,000. I think it's actually somewhere in April that we need the $500,000. I think we only need about $200,000 by April 1st.
Well, but
a mere $200,000.
The last official memo from the boss said that he was trying to get $500,000.
Oh, no, that's understood, that he's trying to get that.
Right.
But the question of whether or not we're on the air as of April Fool's Day.
Yes, that's 200.
Is a $200,000.
Beyond what we have now.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
And in the past, we could look to the foundation, our owners in California, for a loan, for a payback on the money that we used to give them until the money started going directly to them. And now they're tapped out because we're not the only one of the five stations that have been siphoning off their money. Our Washington station, PFW, has had to move at the same time that we have had to move. And KPFA made a move how long ago? Didn't KPFA, like, buy a building or something?
Oh, that was decades ago, I think.
I don't think so. Well, according
they
to...
They moved the offices, and they may have built the archives.